Okay, and again, why did, or what does that document?
Well, basically what was going on is every year Xerox had a meeting with their top 200 or so executives. And so this was their annual meeting for that. And one of the days of that meeting was reserved for us to give them basically a huge dog and pony show,
right,
and demos afterwards to kind of show them what we felt was the direction that Xerox should be going in the future. And to get sort of them educated about it and to get buy-in, mm-hmm, from all of these executives. We certainly felt that the top management at Xerox really understood this,
okay,
and, mm-hmm, understood that this was a way to go. But in a company that was as huge as Xerox at that point, there, mm-hmm, are huge layers of senior management that needed to basically change their way of thinking. It's a whole different ball game, marketing and selling things like computer systems,
mm-hmm,
literal systems,
right,
versus black box copiers.
Right.
And so they needed to get buy-in from these people. So this whole show was intended to be sort of their introduction to the future, mm, of Xerox.
And how did they receive it?
Generally speaking, I guess it would be easy to say not terribly well.
In what way?
Not real well.
How could you measure that? Or did they just,
well,
look at it?
Well, measure it by the success Xerox has had over the years in the computer business.
Right. But I mean, was it, did they just say, oh, this is not something we're interested in? Or did they just not comprehend?
They just didn't get it.
Yeah.
They just didn't get it or didn't want to get it.
Right.
Depending.
Right.
Everybody had their own fiefdom, whether it was big or small.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they knew how to do what it was they were doing, and they just didn't grok the whole idea of personal computers and laser. I mean, even though laser printers were essentially fancied up copiers, they even resisted that. Why do we want to get into that business? Let somebody else print it, and we'll make copies.
Right. Oh, yeah, it's logical, I guess.
We make copies.
So did you truck all those computers in from somewhere else? Or?
We flew them in from California. Originally, we had a soundstage on a movie lot down in Hollywood rented for 2 or 3 months beforehand where we prepped all of this, rehearsed the show. We literally put on this huge multimedia show with two professional actors that were acting as essentially the MCs,
right,
and the introducers. And we had a number of little vignettes that went on showing different programs. And in fact, one of the things that I did during the show, which was kind of silly, we needed a laser printer to print a copy of a document on cue.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't figure out a way to do that. I mean, because, you know, if you literally would have sent it from the machine, there would have been some time that took place while it was formatted.
Right.
And then maybe by then the printer had kind of gone into standby mode. So what we did is the Altos all had a debugger on them called SWAT. And you could go into the debugger by giving the right key combination and then exit out of the debugger to the thing that you were immediately doing before you went into there by doing a control P for proceed. And so what we would do is we would get to the point where I would know that the printer was just getting ready to crank out that page, and I would put the Alto in the debugger. And then I'd wait for the cue in the dark from the stage of, and then, I forget what it was, but it was something like, and then you send the document to the printer, and I would hit control P, and the printer would come up and go ka-chunk, ka-chunk, and put out the page. And it was, whoa, cool.
So all this effort, and it was also projected on a screen backlit?
Yeah, we had a full-size professional-type stage. I mean, a huge stage with scrims all in front of it. And two of the big, God, I still can't remember the name of those projectors, but they were projectors that allowed you to project both video or slides. And
mm-hmm.
we had like something like, I don't know, 25 or 30 slide projectors.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes the slides or the pictures would fill the whole screen. Sometimes they'd only fill part, you know. So it was, especially for those days, it was really hotshot multimedia.
Yeah, yes.
And then when the projectors went away and the lights could light up any of, I think it was four individual sort of office scenes behind the scrims.
Right.
And so various people all from Xerox, were doing essentially demos of different programs and stuff like that, showing some of the capability that the systems had.
So you were able to project what was on the screen.
And then projected all of that on a big screen as it was happening. Then there's videotapes and stuff still around at Park somewhere of the whole show that we did. And then afterwards, we had a number of machines set up in banquet rooms like this, so people could come in and take a closer look at them. And in fact, they were all required to come in there. And they were all kind of pissed because otherwise they could be out golfing.
Right.
And, yeah. You know,
the kind of stuff that you're supposed to do at these gatherings.
So who championed all this? I mean, who put all that? I mean, it sounded like it was a really big production, and somebody personally invested a lot into it.
Well, Xerox higher management. The top management then thought that this was the way to go and that this was, in fact, the future. And so they essentially made it happen. There were a couple of particular Xerox vice presidents who sort of provided the money for this. Mm-hmm. The people that really did it, one of the guys that's going to be on the panel tomorrow, a guy named John Ellamy, and he was essentially the program manager or whatever you want to call it for this whole thing, along with another guy named Tim Mott. Tim did most of the writing of all the script and everything that we were doing, and John sort of organized everything. But basically, when we left Hollywood after doing all of the stuff, we had our own airplane that we loaded them all on, and all of the printers and all that stuff, and flew it down along with all of us. I don't remember how many of us there was, but there was this huge amount of people that went down there, and then set everything up. Now, one of the things that was a huge problem at this Boca Raton Hotel and Club is they had never before, in any of these banquet rooms, had this much of an air conditioning load. Yeah. And it's hot and humid in Florida.
Yeah.
Well, their air conditioning was melting down, and it just wasn't happening at all. So our logistics guy, who has several pictures in there, a guy named Richard Bach, who was just incredible, he was able to pull rabbits out of hats on cue, went down and somehow, through sources that he had, got an Eastern Airlines air conditioning truck that you normally hook up to a Boeing 747, drove it up the freeway. These things don't drive on the freeway at, you know, 25 miles an hour from the airport to the Boca Raton Hotel and Club. We backed it into the back of this banquet room building. We had busboys out there hacking shrubbery away with machetes to be able to get it close enough so that they could patch it into that area's air conditioning system. And then somebody taught, one of the guys from Eastern Airlines taught David Boggs how to run it, you know, with all of the hydraulics and how to do it. And Boggs thought this was great. So Boggs was the official Eastern Airlines air conditioning truck.
So
that we had enough air conditioning so that we didn't melt down during all these demos.
Isn't that wonderful? All this effort.
We did stuff that was just incredible. And God, we spent so much money and partied so hard, but worked so hard too. It was just incredible.
And then the result that was in 1978?
Probably something like that,
And then there was no initiative from the middle management, no memos.
In fact,
no,
I wonder if there might be something on the back of one of these pictures for the date.
You know what I heard or read somewhere was that the wives of these managers understood what was going on and got excited.
Better than
them. Is that true?
Yes. I heard the same thing. I mean, I didn't talk to any of them, so I don't have first-hand knowledge, but I've heard exactly the same thing.
Were you running demos on some of the systems for people? Well, what typically would you
show? That was one of the things that I often did, because since we were the group that was actually building these machines, whenever people would visit El Segundo from outside of El Segundo, people from within Xerox, other areas, or from Fuji Xerox in Japan or whatever, our place was always on their list of places to stop and see. And so it seemed like I was given Alto demos, sometimes 3, 4, 5 times a week.
What typically would you show?
I'd certainly show them Bravo and all the standard programs and
some of the games, tic-tac-toe and stuff.
I did, and some of the small talk stuff. You know, sometimes write a quickie little small talk program to draw something cool for them or something like that. So just a number of things. So yeah, I did that a lot.
What years were you working on the Alto?
Well, I started working at it on them right at the very start, which I guess was probably around 73, because they built at Park in the CSL lab, I think something like maybe 10 Altos, and they thought that was going to be it forever. But then they decided they wanted more. So then they started working with us, and I think the first build was something like 20 or 21 Altos. Mm-hmm. And for quite a while, every build of Altos was supposed to be the last one forever. It was
really?
Like, well, let's build 21 more, and we'll never need any more than that. And
how long would it take to build an Alto?
Beg pardon?
How long did it take to build an Alto then?
With Alto ones, I think the most that we were ever shipping was probably in the area of 2 or 3 systems a week. After we did the redesign with the Alto 2s in sort of this same form factor, I think our typical shipping was more like 12 a week. So not exactly
so total,
by volume.
Total of how many do you think were built? The ones
probably,
and the 2s?
Well, of the Alto 1s, I think was something like maybe 120,
mm-hmm.
kind of in that area. And then Alto 2s, I think was probably a little bit in excess of 2,000. And then I was still in the group that built the Altos for probably around the first 1,200 or so.
Mm.
And then when I left there, I went off and joined the Advanced Systems Department, which
right.
is the where L&D was working at that point, became the Alto User Group Coordinator. Xerox had started up an internal Alto Users Group, because mm. by then, Altos were in use all over the place. So I became the Alto Users.
The Carter White House had an
yeah.
Alto on a Dover.
Right? Yeah, yeah, we had some in the Senate and in the White House. And the
CMU had a number
Office
of
Publishing, or whatever you call that back there, had some.
Yeah.
In fact, I went back there a couple of times, because part of my job there was to be Alto User Support Coordinator, as well as doing field support for
mm-hmm.
the Altos.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a lot of traveling in those days to Washington, D.C., to Rochester, Henrietta, Webster. There were some at a Xerox-owned company called Ginn & Company, which was the company that you may remember a little thing when you were in grade school called the Weekly Reader.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of Ginn & Company's publications. Well, they had a bunch of Altos. Xerox owned an outfit in Ann Arbor associated with the University of Michigan called University Press,
mm-hmm.
and that was a company that had Altos as well. And so we had some in Dallas, so I'd go to Dallas and obviously down in El Segundo.
So were the Altos actually sold? Did they have a sticker price on them?
No.
They were
no.
just all?
Some were granted to the university grant sites. They were sold within Xerox.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe any were ever actually sold outside of Xerox. The ones that were outside of Xerox were placed there as a market probe with the idea that when the market mm-hmm. probe ended, Xerox took them back.
Right.
I don't believe any of those were ever actually sold, but there may have been some exceptions. But yes, if you were a group in, say, Rochester or whatever, and felt you needed some Altos to help do your development or whatever it was you wanted to do, you basically put in your order with us, and you would become part of the next build.
Mm.
And once we got some number,
the builds that never seem to end.
Yeah. So and so once we got a number high enough to make it feasible to do another build of Altos, and this was they tended to follow one after the other. So while we were doing one build, orders would be coming in for the next build, and so we'd go off and start buying mm-hmm. parts and all that kind of
what?
Stuff for the next build. And so typically, an Alto 2XM like that would probably cost an internal user within Xerox something like 12, 12.5,
mm-hmm.
something along those lines.
I heard that when Reagan came into the White House, they just turfed all the equipment that had been in the Carter White House, including an Alto in Dover in the basement, and somebody's kid got it or something.
Oh,
and then
really?
When Reagan saw the memos that were coming out of the White House, so these look like shit. Look at Carter's memos. Look at ours, our cloth ribbon printer, and what's happened? Well, sir, we just got rid of all the Carter equipment, and they
just like
stepped,
you told us to do.
Yeah, they stepped way back.
Yeah.
So somebody got them.
That seems pretty likely. Seems pretty likely.
That's amazing. Yeah, even though there's a consistent progressive demand, you know, they never translated that to
never
to the open market.
Yeah, never could figure out how to really sell
it. What they were doing was developing this as the commercialization, as the Star 8010.
Yeah. Right.
And what's your understanding of the story behind the Star?
In terms of
did it fail because of the high UMC or?
Well, I think that was a large part of it, but I think the principal problem was being able to market and sell it properly. There was a dedicated sales force to be able to do it, but it never really translated well across all of Xerox and this huge Xerox dedicated sales force. Now, if this kind of thing would have been able to roll out to the entire Xerox sales force, which was humongous, and their marketing machine, despite the cost, mm-hmm. I think it would have been able to sell. But those guys didn't want anything to do with it.
Yeah, they had lower commission on it, and no consumables.
They just didn't get it. You know, I got to think about electronics and displays, and I'll just sell my copier.
Right.
It's a lot easier.
Of course, the copiers ended up with displays and electronics, too.
Yeah.
Now, these 6085, these brown boxes here, that was just the momentum continuing with the Star.
Yeah, just the next logical generation.
And they went all the way into the late 80s before these guys, they didn't get manufactured anymore. Then they moved to the Sun, right? And then they Global View for the PC,
right,
for Windows,
right.
All of which we'll see tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, so the original deal was to port all the software to Suns, which was a technological coup in itself.
Since it was
all written in Mesa, you couldn't exactly go through and just rewrite it all and see. It would take you forever, as long as it took you to do the Mesa. And so Park came up with basically a Mesa to C cross-compiler. And you feed Mesa in one side and get C out the other side, and it runs on the Sun. I mean, it was obviously a little more complex than that, but that's pretty much the way it went.
And in fact, there's that Sun there. At the DigiBarn, we had a Spark Station 5 as the reliable server to run all these machines, because it was much better than trying to run it on a server like that. And then we were running it on Windows. It only runs under Windows 2000, because it ran under Windows NT or something,
or
early NT. And then we ran Maze War on that. And on this and on these, so we were able to play Maze War. And of course, the Elixir system over there is a very different thing. It has the look and feel of the Star environment, but is not anywhere near the functionality. It was a dedicated workstation to generate the print resources for the big laser printers.
Yeah.
I attempted to make it more general purpose. See on that T-shirt, there's all these workflows and there's accounts and stuff to drive the DocuTech, but it was still a graphical shell with DOS underneath, but all you could do. But in fact, it ran on a 640K BASIC 286 was the real, and it had a good look and feel.
I've always been absolutely astounded how good programmers were able to get so much out of DOS and early Windows. I mean, understanding all of the sweat and effort that went into these guys with the pilot operating system sitting underneath there, which was a real operating system as opposed to sort of a toy operating system like DOS or Windows on top of DOS. And it always astounded me that people were good enough and clever enough to be able to actually do some really good stuff sitting on top of
that ran on an XT, believe it or not.
Yeah.
On a 1664 by 1200 monitor with 2 megs of RAM and a board. And this was due to the very, very good effective programming of the digital research team that built GEM with Graphical Environment Manager, incredibly thin layer that took 80K or 100K. And then the entire desktop environment there, the GUI was 300K in size, and it ran applications by exiting itself completely, and it was replaced by the app. So the desktop would disappear, and then the application, like the font editor, or forms, or graphics editor, would start up, and then you would exit. And there was a queuing model where there was no multitasking. But it was very difficult, because I wrote that with all in, initially it was in Pascal, but then we moved to C with no debugger or any sort of tools like that. And so I had to, every bit of code I wrote had to check boundaries, array boundaries, and be incredibly tight and well thought out before. You couldn't just pour code out, because there was no operating system per se there to help you. There was no way to pop up something and find out the status of memory. It was all completely your space, and DOS couldn't help you. It was up to you.
Yeah.
And we when we delivered some of these Elektra systems with the big Sigma display, which I wish I had a card for, because it looked like a star. And we would do things like running the little dispatcher or the converters, and would I think exit, because it was running a batch file, run the converter in DOS, because you couldn't have all the converters in the operating environment, produce the output, come back, and show the right window. So it would do conversions. It would run extensible my modules by exiting itself, continuing to run the next statement in the batch file, which I'd written in. Because the batch file starts it, runs the desktop. If you exit the desktop, it's going to go to the next statement in the batch file. That was the trick to doing modules. And then the desktop itself wrote the next statement in its own batch file. And then it would write a statement to come back to the desktop and pass itself parameters back. So that was the model by which we made this work.
How much can you keep track of?
Yeah, I call it gerbils running in the background on the wire cage, the wire wheels. But it's served 4,000 Xerox customers in 100 operating companies, 100 operating countries, and filled that gap that the Star 685 couldn't get to the high-speed printers. And it ran on a regular machine. It would run on those Toshiba laptops with orange VGA screens, and it would, you know. And when 386s came out, it started to really rock. You know, 486, and of course, this is some old 486 here. But running, I can switch here to Windows 3.1, but this is a couple of years before Windows 3.0. But it was fun writing it, and that's where I got interested in the Xerox legacy.
Yeah, I'll bet.